Shalom and welcome again to today's edition of Secrets of Meaning, the podcast of Jewish Sacred Aging. I'm your host, Rabbi Richard Adress. In these podcasts, we hope to explore some of the issues that touch on our families, our communities, and ourselves as a result of the ongoing revolution in longevity. And you can contact us via our homepage, JewishSacredAging.com, or through our Facebook page, Jewish Sacred Aging on Facebook. We welcome your comments either on the voicemail icon on the website or to me directly, Rabbi Adress at JewishSacredAging.com. And with great pleasure, we welcome to the Seekers of Meaning podcast microphone an old friend of mine, Dr. Tussie Schneider, author of a brand new book called One Congregation's Journey of Change, subtitled A Guide to Enriching Relationships in Your Congregation. Hi, Tussie. How you doing?
Hi, Richie. I'm fine. How are you?
Well, fine. You're in the beautiful South Florida, if I'm not mistaken, the West Coast, right?
West Coast, Southwest Coast of Florida. That's correct.
So, full disclosure, I've known this young lady for a few years, and we worked together on some URJ projects for the Reform Movement and through WRJ, the Women of Reform Judaism. And Tussie, your own journey of change, interestingly enough, leads you to write this book. Talk to me a little bit about this journey that you were on that led to the publication of the book, and also let people know how one can get a hold of the book.
Okay. First, the book is not out yet. It will be out early in January. I don't have a publication date yet, but I'm hoping it'll be sometime in the first half of January.
So sometime soon. This is
post. Sometime soon. Right, it's a sometime. Much longer process than I knew.
Yeah, it happens. So will it be available online or public, you know, in print?
It will be available at all of the usual
outlets.
It'll be on Amazon. It will be available in print as well as an ebook. So people should be able to find it wherever they usually go to get books.
So A Journey of Change, One Congregation's Journey. Talk to me. Why did you write this?
Well, I have had a long time interest in congregations as effective organizations. That is a desire to see congregations carrying out their missions in a manner that is consistent with their values. This book is a step-by-step guide to helping congregations navigate through the process of changing their focus to one on values and to give congregations tools to use for that purpose.
Now, you experimented with your own congregation, right? This is the test market?
I wouldn't call it testing it with a congregation. Actually, we began the process of change 5 years ago. The rabbi asked my husband and I to lead an initiative. And about a year into the process, I realized that I had the beginnings of a book already because I take notes, detailed notes in everything that we do. And I realized I had a way to start a book. And so I just started writing along with while we were experiencing our change. And I was inspired to write the book by my experiences in WRJ and URJ leadership, the training I received attending biennials, and my graduate studies at The Ohio State University. The URJ taught and WRJ would teach us always to share our successes with others. And that was a large part of why I decided to go ahead and write this book.
You write in the beginning that one of the motivating factors in looking at cultural change, if I can use that expression within a congregation, is this concept of engaged congregants. What do you mean by that?
The concept of an engaged congregant has many implications. In the book, in the chapter on best practices, I discuss the importance of members to the temple. Members are the main labor force. They are the volunteers. They are the main source of funds. their annual contributions, whether it be dues or a pledge, and the fundraising that they do. Congregants that are connected, engaged in the life of the congregation, and are passionate about their participation are more likely to support the congregation and less likely to leave.
So this concept of engagement, you draw out the analogy and really the one of the thesis of the book, because it's in your subtitle, is really emphasizing the power of human relationships. Some of the stuff that we used to do in the care and community work, the Wilson book, and this is a very popular thing right now. Talk to me a little bit about what you found in your research and trying to impress on your particular congregation this idea of that the most important thing within that congregation are the human relationships that are established.
Relationships are central to the members' connection to the congregation. Some congregations and many congregations today have what we call a transactional culture, which is one that stimulates a fee-for-service mindset. It focuses on headcounts and offering programs. It's saying to the world, join our congregation because we offer this or that program. And it is mostly an outreach focus. A relational culture, one that focuses on relationships, is focused on the members and their relationship with each other and with the temple. It is based in values, the values of inclusion, equality, the sacredness of relationships, and it is mostly an in-reach focus. Moving from one to the other, from the transactional culture to the relational culture, is a very slow process. Mm-hmm. Cultural shifts do not happen overnight. They don't happen quickly at all. They usually work best when the leadership, the lay and professional leadership, is moving in the same direction.
Let me ask you a question based upon that, because this comes up, and I'm starting to see this as I travel too. In your research, in your study, and in your application of your research and study in the book, do you think that the emphasis, and we're speaking specifically of synagogues, the emphasis on creating a relational-based congregation, does it take precedence over belief? Is belief becoming secondary within the context of a congregation?
No, I don't see it that way at all. It is not a matter of one taking priority over the other. A congregant that is engaged will have opportunities to explore his or her beliefs as he or she participates in temple life, as much or as little as they want. In my experience, many Reformed Jews, and we seem to come from many diverse backgrounds, are somewhere in development in regarding their religious beliefs. They aren't absolutely sure about anything, and they're still growing and learning, and they have opportunities to explore that while they are participating in their whatever their way is in the congregation.
So just talk to me a little bit, just unpack that a little bit more. I mean, is this a movement to stress relational Judaism, to be, pardon the cynicism, is it some sort of reaction to the phenomenon now that you mentioned, this fee-for-service Judaism?
Most definitely.
Ah.
When our rabbi attended a CCAR meeting, I think he was already, and that's where he first heard of Ron Wilson and his book. Many of the clergy and lay leaders have become concerned and with a growing sense of the transactional nature of our congregations and a concern that this culture is not in line with our values. And that was certainly the case for our rabbi when he attended that CCAR meeting, and it was spring of 2013. He had been searching for some kind of cultural change, cultural shift that was more closely aligned with our values, our our Reform values, our Jewish values. And he immediately recognized the potential that relational Judaism provided.
You write about in the book, Tussie, and you allude to this, and this has become, I see this being discussed more and more around the country, differences between being a member as opposed to belonging. How do you make that differentiation, and how do you describe that in the context of your work?
Well, in Jewish congregations, members are generally anyone who pays dues or makes a pledge, depending on the system in that congregation. Belonging is a much deeper connection. It's a matter of being a part of the temple family. And we've often talked about temple family over the years, but it wasn't until we started this process that I really understood what that meant. It is having a passion for the congregation values and really wanting to live those values. So belonging is a much deeper concept. I recently asked a friend who's very active in her church, what does one have to do to become a member of your church? You know, is it just a matter, you just join like we do by paying dues? And she said, oh no, they have to get up in front of the congregation and declare their belief in the tenets of that faith. I didn't know that until she told me that. I was very surprised. We don't do anything like that. We don't ask anyone to declare their beliefs. But we do hope that they will become involved in the life of the congregation. And once they're participating and engaging in some aspect of the life of the congregation, they will have opportunities to develop their religious concepts, their beliefs. And I would imagine in a congregation of say roughly 1,000 adults, there are probably 1,000 different descriptions of their religious belief, especially since we all come from so many different backgrounds. We have people who have Reformed Jewish backgrounds and have always been a Reformed Jew, people who come from other denominations of Judaism, you know, the conservative or Orthodox families. We have people who have had other religious backgrounds, people who may or may not have converted to Judaism. And we have people who have no religious background. So you put all those people together in one place and you have a lot of different expectations and beliefs.
What would happen in your congregation if, you know, on Rosh Hashanah this year, the rabbi stood up and said, you know, part of belonging to this community is we really want to push you on what you believe, and we want to really urge you to really come to grips with these certain spiritual beliefs. And what do you think would it be the reaction on the part of your congregants if that was a priority stated from the pulpit on the high holidays?
I think you'd see a mass walkout.
Really?
Yes. I don't think I don't see Jews as being comfortable having to do that. And Jews in general. I mean, there may be a few who would love to do it, but I just don't think there are too many that would be very comfortable stating their belief.
See, I my experience, especially working in our population, is that there seems to, I find a real hunger to have conversations around this, but the entryway is difficult because we've never really done it. And that's why I wanted to, you know, ask you that, because I think we're missing a golden opportunity as you reshape cultures of congregations to really engage people in what really do you believe? What is, just as you're asking the congregation as an entity to really look at itself in sort of like a spiritual mirror. We do that once a year in depth on Yom Kippur. But for some reason, we retreat after that into programming, which I guess is part of the challenge of what you're doing with the book in trying to move that off to the emphasis on programming, as you spoke about before, into a deeper sense of relationships. And hopefully that engages the culture change. But it just fascinates me.
Richie, I think if you know if members of the congregation were in a class setting, you know, where they were, you know, taking an adult education class or studying with the rabbi for a particular purpose, I think in that setting, in a small group setting, they might be willing to discuss what they believe. I know I did that when I was preparing for my bat mitzvah when I was in my 40s.
Right.
And I met with the rabbi weekly, and he didn't have to teach me Hebrew. So we had all kinds of other discussions. And, you know, we did talk about what I believed, but that was just him and me. And I wasn't standing in front of the entire congregation belief.
No, don't misunderstand. I'm not asking for people in Russia to affirm their belief I'd love to know if congregations actually do, as part of their orientation, as part of their working with individuals, do ask people to really take some time and confront what they really believe, as opposed to just writing a check and hopefully attending a meeting or an event or a program or getting the bar and bat mitzvah and then saying thank you very much, which is why I think the importance of what you've written in One Congregation's Journey of Change, your book, really can have some impact on congregations. You include in each section, Tassi, a biblical text as sort of like an intro. Why did you choose to begin each section with an appropriate biblical text?
Well, I wanted to demonstrate and make it very clear that what we are doing, the changes that we're undergoing, are based in Torah. That that moving in this direction is what we often refer to as leading Jewishly. I thought it was the congregation responded very well to, you know, any change that we made, if we talked about our values, mm-hmm. and that we were not that we were making this change to make more money or to increase the size of the congregation or to, you know, for some other mundane reason, but that we were trying to align what we were doing with our Jewish values. And they responded very well to that. And that inspired me to put the Torah quotes at the beginning of each chapter.
You also include in one of the sections, I don't remember what page, this wonderful quote from Peter Drucker, the guru of management, on the goal. And I use this actually in some of the talks I give with congregations, that the goal of the nonprofit, which is what synagogues are, especially nonprofit, is the goal of that is a changed human being. Why is that such a powerful quote?
Well, first of all, it's a quote I came across many years ago, and I've used it many times. It's one of my favorite quotes. And I think I'd like to read it because for our listeners, so they'll understand what you and I are talking about. This is the quote. "The nonprofit institution neither supplies goods or services nor controls. Its product is neither a pair of shoes nor an effective regulation. Its product is a changed human being. The nonprofit institutions are human change agents. Their product is a cured patient, a child that learns, a young man or woman grown into a self-respecting adult, a changed human life altogether." End quote. Like I said, it's one of my favorite quotes, and I use it often when I address temple boards. So often temple boards get caught up in the business of temple, the money aspects, and sometimes they forget that the temple is not just a business. Yes, we have to behave in a business-like way when it comes to the money, the money that people are giving to the temple. We have to take that very seriously. But we exist for a different purpose. We need to include our reasons for being in our planning and decision-making. Are we being true to our values and our mission? Are we meeting the needs of our members and our community when we make decisions? I think sometimes these things get forgotten, and it's important for the boards to recognize the difference. And that's why I frequently share that quote with boards. Another very similar quote, and I don't have the quote directly, but Drucker and others have described the difference between the for-profit and not-for-profit organization in terms of the bottom line. In the for-profit organization, the bottom line is expressed in terms of dollars. Have they increased or at least maintained their level of profit? The bottom line for a nonprofit organization is not dollars, but it is in changed human lives, something, of course, much more difficult to measure.
Right. The challenge also in congregational life is that those changed, the changing of a human life takes years. And yes. that's, and so we've all had this experience with boards, sometimes with lay leadership, that they create a program and they want a result. And if it didn't, you know, sometimes as you alluded to, it's the numbers game. But what we're really trying to do is over the course of years and years and years of relationships, move a human being and change them and let them grow and evolve. And that takes time often. And that's a challenge.
Well, that's a real challenge. One way that that challenge has been addressed, and it's what I used in my research, is the concept of reputational effectiveness.
Which means what in English?
It means the opinion of the people involved, both inside and outside of the congregation, regarding that congregation. Do they see that congregation as a healthy, effective, functioning organization, or do they see it as the opposite, as an organization in trouble, not able to deal with the differences among its members and its various constituencies? So it's and instead of making the opinion of people or saying that opinion is not important, it's not measurable, so to speak, they measure that opinion and make it more important, because that the people inside a congregation know when it's not working well. They sense that, and they will report that if you do a survey. I know congregations are very reluctant to participate in surveys. But I found some when I was doing my research. Of course, the research was with two highly functioning congregations.
Right.
They had no problem sharing their views of what was going on in their congregation, because their congregations were very healthy. I would like to have done the same study with congregations that weren't healthy, but that didn't happen.
Also, you have to get congregations to admit that we're not healthy. And in truth, look, a lot of our people, when they get to that situation within a particular community, they do not vote vocally. They vote with their feet and lift sleeves.
Absolutely.
In the book, you talk a little bit about, well, in the process of changing the culture, many congregations have what they call mission statements. And you write also about this concept of vision. Tussie, what in your understanding is the difference between a congregational mission statement, but a vision for the congregation?
Vision is a loftier concept than mission. It refers to the questions of what do we want to be? What is the future we want to create? It is usually a very lofty statement. A mission statement describes who we are, what we do, who we do it for, and why we do it. It's very here and now, and does need to be changed every so many years because it will change. A vision statement usually doesn't change too much over time because there might be some slight changes as time goes on and new people are in leadership, but the vision statement is a much longer lasting statement as opposed to the mission statement, which should be reviewed every few years. In the book and in my research, I talk about sharing the vision, and that is a little bit different in concept. It refers to sharing with the rest of the congregation what the information regarding the vision and the mission, the information that the board has, but the membership might not have. In some cases, even the board members can't tell you what the mission is of their organization.
True, true.
And sadly so. I recommend that the mission statement be developed in a group process, collective process, either by the entire board or an ad hoc committee, but be developed in a group process and then shared with a larger group. If it's an ad hoc committee, then they would share it with the board, and the board would have to approve it for it to become the mission statement of the congregation. But once the that has been done, once there is an approved mission statement, I think it needs to appear monthly in the a monthly bulletin, if there is one, assuming most congregations have some sort of monthly bulletin, that it be in the Friday night handout, if there is one. We call ours the Shabbat Shalom, and it's right on the front page. The mission statement is there every single week. It's every single month inside the front cover of our monthly bulletin. And it appears on other publications, such as our membership brochure, or questionnaire.
Right, right.
It appears in a lot of different places. And it's, to my great joy, it includes our one family concept. It is very much a part of what we do as one family. I'm sorry, I don't know if I've said it before or not. I want to say it now. We named our relational initiative One Family.
Right.
And that has become synonymous with the name of our temple, who we are, what we do, the concept of One Family, and it's a big part of our logo. It's part of our mission statement. It's on our letterhead. Everywhere. We call ourselves One Family, Many Connections.
So it's your brand, in essence.
It is our brand. And we developed that in a process that took several months in our marketing and communications committee.
So we're speaking with Dr. Tussie Schneider, the author of One Congregation's Journey of Change, subtitled A Guide to Enriching Relationships in Your Congregation, available quite soon on the usual suspects, including the great god Amazon. Tussie, you know, you alluded to the economics, et cetera, et cetera. Let's talk to something before we start running out of time here. In part of your One Family Revolution, and the name of your congregation is what, by the way?
It's Temple Shalom in Naples, Florida.
Temple Shalom in Naples, Florida. And you are part of a small but growing trend of congregations to forget about paying dues. And you have, so if somebody walks into your community right now and wants to belong to your community, there's no dues, correct?
No dues.
And so how do you pay the rabbi?
And no building fund.
How do you pay the light bill, the teachers, the rabbi? How do you do that?
Okay. Well, first of all, the religious school is separate from, it's a separate
Okay, but yeah. but what? So how do you how do you raise the money? I mean,
what we did in a very carefully worded letter to the congregation, we explained that we wanted to bring our financial support system in line with our values. We focused on values and a Torah quote about how God told Moses to ask the Israelites to bring gifts as their hearts moved them to build the Mishkan. And so that Torah quote is very much a part of our pledge system. And in this pledge system, we give the congregant the dollar amount that it costs to sustain the building, the operations of the temple. We gave that amount was arrived at very carefully with all the considerations in mind, and it is shared with the congregation as part of the annual pledge system. But we say right up front, if this amount is not possible or comfortable for you, you choose how much you want to contribute. If you can't afford it, make a pledge. It will be accepted. No matter what you pledge, it will be accepted as your dues or as your annual pledge share.
Right.
And if you can give more, of course we would love that. And we do have some people who pledge more. Interestingly enough, in the first year of this process, not only did we meet our financial expectations, but we superseded them. It partly because our membership increased by 40%, if you can imagine such a thing. So we are busily working on integrating all of these new members. And between the time we started One Family in early in 2014 to current day, our congregation numbers have gone up about 40%. And that's a lot of members.
It's a lot. I'm sure there are colleagues and lay leadership who may be listening to that and saying, wow. So you began the One Family and this financial restructuring in 2014. We're at the dawn of 2019. And so has the level of participation in the non-dues program continued, or did the newness of it peak and has it fallen off? Because I think a lot of people are concerned in congregations who are contemplating this as to the sustainability over the long haul. And you've had several years of experience now. Has that level of participation, have you continued to meet the financial obligations based upon the voluntary system?
Yes. Yes. All right. The mindset and behavior of the congregants has changed dramatically. The participation is amazing. Every project that we did that our One Family team developed was either all or mostly covered by donations for that project. Wow. Because at the beginning, at the first couple of years, we didn't even have a budget. And we knew that anything that we were going to do, well, I'll give you the first example. At one of our first meetings in our brainstorming session, the members of the One Family team identified name badges as something that they really wanted to do. And this was priority, you know, at the top of the list. And I said to them, I said, you know, this costs money. I told you, we do not have a budget. And somebody stood up and said, I will cover the cost of the name badges. And somebody else stood up and said, I own a woodworking company. I will donate the cabinet to hold the name badges. And so that first project set the example, set the process by which most of our projects were done. And there might have been a piece of a project that ended up being part of the temple budget. But for the most part, the projects have been covered by somebody stepping up and saying, I want to cover that. That's important to me.
But
let's do it.
But I just want to be clear for in case somebody is concerned. The One Family Project, that's the brand for what you're trying to do for the congregation. But the congregational operating budget, you know, what it costs to, you know, run,
yes,
to pay the bills and the light and the administrative assistant and the rabbi and whatever, whatever, whatever. That's continuing to be met by the voluntary dues program, correct?
Yes, it is. And partly because of all the new members. I mean, a lot of new members, you know, it, even if they didn't pledge large amounts of money, when you add them all up, there, you know, there's...
Gotcha. Right.
And
right.
And some did pledge, you know, more than what they had to. So, or more than what, you know, the sustaining amount that we shared with them. It's just been an amazing experience to see this, what has happened in this congregation. It is, Friday night services are unbelievably wonderful. The rabbi has done an amazing job with the Friday night service, making it upbeat and welcoming and something that people want to come back to. We have worked diligently to make sure that the people, you know, that were there on Friday night who came to the Oneg were treated with welcome and, you know, not standing alone somewhere in a corner waiting for somebody to talk to them.
Right.
We have a whole system to make sure that doesn't happen.
So again, the book is called One Congregation's Journey of Change, A Guide to Enriching Relationships in Your Congregation. The author, Dr. Tussie Schneider, available quite soon through the local and national and usual suspects of how to obtain books. And I will also mention that in addition, this is a very, very complex book. Complex in the fact that it delves into a lot of the nitty-gritty and how-tos, but also a very interesting and important appendix towards the end of the book that deals with such issues as organizational readiness, a checklist for that, which is quite extensive, and several conditions, 10 conditions to motivating volunteers, which every congregation, every community organization faces on an ongoing basis. So again, One Congregation's Journey of Change, A Guide to Enriching Relationships in Your Congregation. Tussie, congratulations on the publication of this book, on your research. And thank you very much for joining us here on today's edition of Seekers of Meaning. And I wish you continued success. Good luck with the book. I'm sure you will be asked by many people to give them the benefit of your experience and the congregation's experience. So good luck with that. And just stay healthy and say hello to Neil. And hopefully we'll run into each other somewhere in South Florida.
That would be wonderful.
If not other places.
I would like to thank you for this opportunity. This has been an amazing experience for me to share my book in this way. But I also want to thank our rabbi, our leadership, our members. They are the heart and soul of One Family, and it's pretty rare that when we ask somebody to do something that they'll say no. We don't usually get that. And so this is an amazing congregation of people who have come from all over the country here. We have a lot of people such as my husband and I who came from northern communities and settled here, along with our snowbirds who are here for a few months in the winter. So we are very diverse, but lots of different backgrounds, lots of different ideas about what a congregation should be. And somehow it's all working really well.
Well, congratulations, because you're part of that motivation to make that work. So continued success and take care and happy new year, happy secular year, and just stay healthy. Okay? And thank you.
Thank you. Same to you, Reggie.
Thank you again for joining us on today's edition of Seekers of Meaning, the podcast of Jewish Sacred Aging. Reminder that we welcome your comments and contact at our homepage, jewishsacredaging.com, or to me directly at rabbi@jewishsacredaging.com. And again, we invite you to visit our Jewish Sacred Aging Facebook page. Seekers of Meaning is produced by Steve Lubetkin and recorded at the studios of Lubetkin Global Media here in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. Thanks again for joining us, and we look forward to greeting you on the next Seekers of Meaning, the podcast of Jewish Sacred Aging. I'm your host, Rabbi Richard Address. Thank you, and shalom.